have a tremendous passion for this particular area, animal welfare. We have many people here who also share what is very important to us. I'd like to start off by thanking Planning and Development. I left here today from Planning and Development, who's been a great help for me personally in pulling this together between two of the testes. But I'd like to also acknowledge Christopher Fletcher, who's here, from the same senator's office, from the 34th District Senator Lynn McDonnell. And Chris, I want to let the members know, your tireless effort working with us and getting this started are greatly appreciated, and thank you. Thank you very much. Appreciate this. So with that being said, we're going to convene the meeting. What I'd like to speak before I turn it over to Diane is a brief flow of discussion, sharing thoughts, ideas, concepts. I believe our goal should be over the course of time crystallize what we'd like to move forward with, formalize wherever those agenda items are, and tend to memorialize some of the items into the form of perhaps a couple of different resolutions as time goes on. So thank you for your time, thank you for your commitment, and thank you for your part throughout this very important mission.
I would also like to thank everybody for attending and being part of this task force. I'm excited about it, and I'm hoping that we can improve animal care in Connecticut through the dog pounds and rescues and stuff like that. And I just can't wait to get started.
Okay. We have from Planning and Development some packets that were passed out. In it is some very good information. I'd like to thank Raymond here, who put together a list of outstanding information for us to review over the course of time. And I'd like to start with item number 3 with an open discussion of members. So, Ray, I'm going to start with you.
Thank you. My name is Ray Connors. I am the supervisor of the State Animal Control Division and the Chief Animal Control Officer for the State of Connecticut. I am very pleased to be on this task force. I think that a lot of the issues that are called for in this task force for its findings are long overdue. I look forward to working with this committee and task force and presenting to the General Assembly a good packet that will work for not only the municipalities but the state of Connecticut.
My name is Mark Bailey. I'm the chairman of the Humane Commission in New Haven, Connecticut, and involved in many aspects of companion animal rescue and advocacy. It strikes me today as an especially auspicious occasion. Several pieces of key legislation were passed in Connecticut regarding animal welfare. Two of those become law today, and this task force is meeting for the first time today. So October 1st is a wonderfully optimistic day to energize our efforts on behalf of animal welfare here in Connecticut. I see a great need to be able to address these issues at the statewide level, where the same imperative that's shared among the municipalities in Connecticut but are nevertheless tend to be dealt with in isolated fashion can be dealt with at this level and discussed and perhaps even enacted in a more cohesive manner, where the common goals and common resources are things that we can share and benefit from, and then ultimately even tap into the national resources in humane welfare, which are actually quite advanced, quite remarkable in many ways, and where we see significant sources of funding. So I think this is an especially opportune time in humane welfare to be taking on this challenge and to be doing so with some wonderful goals in mind.
Hello, my name is Paula Poplaski. I am the chairperson of the New Britain Animal Welfare Commission. I have been an advocate for animals, I think, since birth. I'm very excited to be here and very excited to get things moving forward.
My name's Deborah Fuller. I work for the judicial branch. I was appointed by the Chief Court Administrator. My professional life doesn't really have anything to do with animals, but I have a lot of experience in legislation. I've been the judicial branch's legislative liaison for about 20 years, so I am familiar with many of the bills that have gone through in the past concerning animals. Some of them have impacted courts, and I just look forward to listening and lending any expertise that I may have to the discussion.
With a free flow of dialogue on some of the thoughts and opinions that this task force may have. Ray, I know that you, being a state animal control officer, have a great deal of experience in this on a broad basis in Connecticut. I'd like to get your thoughts first, if that's okay.
Yeah, it would be, actually. Standards of humane treatment. I mean, we have dog pound regulations. First of all, I know what the task force is called, municipal shelters, but by definition, actually, there's no such thing. We still call them dog pounds, which is so antiquated that I think that's the first thing that should be changed, is that they should be called shelters and not pounds. It's just, you know, we're not in the 1960s anymore. It's time to modernize that terminology, just like dog wardens or dog catchers are no longer in existence. It's animal control officers. But to get back to item number one, standards of humane treatment, we do have regulations that that allow for a standard of what each municipal shelter is required to have. I had an earlier discussion with one of my task force members here about a municipal shelter in a large city, and it's an antiquated facility, and a lot of municipalities need to really take a hard look at some of these facilities that were built in the 1950s and 1960s, because they're not up to the standard of what we actually have for dog pound regulations now. Before this task force was formed, I was actually looking at these regulations for updating, so I think this task force will benefit greatly that we could possibly get these for dog pound regulations, which I'd like to change to municipal shelter regulations, updated, and so it would especially benefit the health and well-being of the animals that are in the charge of the municipal animal control officers. Thank you.
excuse me. In full agreement with that, of course, I think one of the things to think about are how these standards really are enacted and realized in particular shelters throughout the state. To address what I'd say a public policy matter that almost doesn't make sense, but is one that is very real that I have encountered on several occasions, and that is a dog can be abandoned in a certain location and be treated to the highest level of humane standards and as a result be adopted within a few weeks to a month to a very loving home. That very same dog can be abandoned just 500 yards to the right over the border to the next town and not receive the same level of care and treatment and wind up being euthanized. It's a kind of public policy or practice situation that to me especially doesn't make sense in a state this size. And therefore looking at the standards of humane treatment and making sure those standards really are coordinated and upheld from one municipality to the next in spite of the various differences of those municipalities is incredibly important. Because another situation happens, quite honestly, and this happens frequently as well, that, for instance, someone will come across an abandoned animal in a certain municipality, and knowing the record of care or the likelihood of how that animal will be treated will actually take the animal, drive to a different municipality with a better record, and pretend that they found that animal there, and just because that person believes the animal will have a better chance of being treated well and, of course, finding a home and not being euthanized. This is happening quite a bit, and this, of course, isn't really fair to the shelters on either side. It allows some shelters not to address some of the real challenges they face in terms of the humane treatment, the standards of humane treatment, and in a sense it almost penalizes those shelters which have a really terrific live release rate, that they're having animals brought to them that actually weren't within their jurisdiction. That's just one of the things I think this particular item can help address and that we can help with as well.
I definitely agree with you, Mark. I experienced that very same things in my facility because we have a good record of placement. We have a good record of volunteers to walk dogs and take care of them and spend time with them and groom them and wash them and bathe them and bed them. And some surrounding towns do not do that. So I find that I found the dog on such and such a road in such and such a town, and you can tell, look at the people, mm-hmm. that is not where they found the dog. So I do agree with you.
Deborah?
Do we have a list, or does a list exist of the shelters that are out there? Because I don't have any background knowledge, so I don't know if they're all municipal. Some must be regional. Does every town have to have one? I just need a little base knowledge. It would be helpful if we had something that we could get distributed at some later point.
Ray, do we have that at the state level from your experience?
Yes, actually, I put a list together recently. We did not have one in existence prior, but we do now, and I could have it for our next task force meeting. And actually, we have all the inspection reports from every facility. Not every town needs to have a place to put their stray dogs. Not all of them have dog pounds. Some of them use commercial kennels, which are allowable by statute. Some of them use veterinary hospitals, which are allowable by statute. So not every municipality is required to. And many municipalities share space with other municipalities. I know that your own town, I think, is in with another, or another town is in with your facility.
Yes. Yeah. We're in a collaborative. The short term of it, how can we improve the existing shelter that we're in, but yet still work on a parallel path to form some sort of regional shelter? So perhaps, Deborah, the first follow-up that we'll have is a list of all the shelters for the task force members. And Ray, if we can ask you to handle that, that'd be great.
Yes, I'll have that for the next meeting.
Any other comments under the recommendations for standards of humane treatment of animals? Mark.
If I may add, looking further out to the national level of humane welfare, and by that I mean the organizations that have a national sort of recognition, even international recognition on behalf of animals, such as Maddie's Fund, even Beagle Freedom Project, which whom we have a representative here today, there is a great deal of funding and resource availability to municipal shelters of all shapes and sizes, as long as they adhere to a basic standard that is considered now to be the conventional standard of humane welfare. It's one that might be so self-evident we would err to neglect to mention it right now, but it is the presumption that all healthy and treatable animals deserve loving homes. In other words, that any abandoned, healthy, and treatable animal will receive the necessary humane care so that that animal may be adopted publicly. This is something that polls in the 70th, above the 70th percentile to the public. And statistics show that when you start adding the words healthy and treatable, that number goes up. This is overwhelmingly the desire of the general public. It is probably that presumption. But for municipal shelters to increase their standard of care, to improve their operations, which not only applies to item one, but I think everything we're looking for, the basic qualification is a commitment to saving healthy and treatable animals and making sure that they are adoptable to the public for the duration of their lives. So I just wanted to mention that as a possible framework for how we look at the various items in front of us.
Diane?
I also want to say that when you say treatable, maybe you and I understand what treatable is and to what extent we need to kind of define that. To what extent?
To tie in what Mark mentioned about the national organizations, one of the things that I learned being here in March testifying to form this task force was the fact that these national organizations will work with states that actually have a formalized task force, state task force in place. So what that means is, if you look at the reality of the municipalities today, the reality is that in every municipal budget, one of the last things that gets attended to is infrastructure improvements at the animal shelter level. And it's sad. Now, I'd like to think in North Haven that that's always on our mind to upgrade that. And I hope that the story we illustrated earlier about the mayor of Hamden and I working together show you that there's at least two chief elected officials across the state, and I know there's many more, that really feel very passionate about this issue. However, in order to access potential funding from the national organizations to get down through and trickle through the municipalities across Connecticut, that is another advantage of having this task force. Because what I learned, and Mark is more of an expert on this than I am, is that by not having a state task force really precludes our ability to have national organizations get behind this. Right, Mark?
Right. And I prepared, for the sake of this meeting, if you'd like to be distributed, just a list of the qualities and qualifications that the national humane advocacy groups are looking for when they provide funding for the various municipalities and shelters. And as I think you'll begin to see as you glance down the list, those items are very similar to the items that we're given the task to address. But to be frank, if without a commitment to healthy and treatable animals, saving healthy and treatable animals and placing them up for adoption by the public, without that basic commitment, to be honest, the national funding isn't there. They will not work to support anything that doesn't acknowledge that basic humane commitment. When that commitment is acknowledged, what the national level is looking for is collaboration and cooperation. They also realize sort of the problem of shelters and pounds working in isolation based on limited resources that are drying up from their municipalities. Rather, what they acknowledge is just as in there are many elements involved in the care that we give our own animals, there's a vet involved, there's a community involved, an organization such as Maddie's Fund wants to see that kind of collaboration as well, wants to see the veterinary community working with the animal control community, working with volunteers, working with the various advocacy groups, coming together, creating these coalitions, creating collaborations. And there you begin to get your checks and balances, which give confidence to the national funding organizations that their money is actually going basically to serve this cause of working step by step, building a program of development to help save more healthy and treatable animals. So the word treatable then starts coming into play because we have the veterinary community involved in helping to make that determination with us. And as you can see, the task force, by its very makeup, is already instilling an image of confidence at that national level, because we have, although she's not here today, a representative of the very veterinary community, the animal control community, the animal advocacy community, the judicial community. This is very basically a team effort as well, and that kind of collaboration.
As a side note to those in the audience, this task force will have three other members, one of whom Mark just referenced. Dr. Kimberly McDonald from the Central Animal Hospital that happens to be in North Haven, one of the top animal hospitals in the state for high-end treatments for animals who may have eye problems, hip replacements they may need, cancer treatments. So we're very delighted to have that in North Haven. We also are going to be having another mayor on this task force, and I've submitted two recommendations for review at the state level. And we're also looking to have a police officer as part of SB 309. And we have the Connecticut Police Chiefs Association coming to us, hopefully, with some recommendations. So, but coming back to item number one, so I think we all agree that we need to formalize some recommendations as we move forward here for the establishment of standards of humane treatment of animals in such shelters. And I happen to like Ray's suggestion about changing the nomenclature, changing the terminology. Any other thoughts on that?
Absolutely. The words make a big difference, as we all know. What we use to describe something, what we call an animal and what we don't call that animal is critical. And sometimes I think half the battle that we're fighting in many cases has to do with the words we're choosing. The words pit bull, for instance. There's just something about using those two words. You choose different words, and suddenly perceptions begin to change. I would love to see the word pound disappear from our discussions, disappear from anywhere it can at the state level.
I also agree with that. A municipal shelter definitely should be changed and used instead.
I agree, too.
Paula? Okay, so we have consensus. Within a half hour, folks, in our first meeting, we have consensus right away on a first recommendation.
Yay!
And that should be a symbolic representation that this is a very cohesive group and will be moving forward. So I would like to also ask for us to contemplate and consider coming to our next meeting with some other recommendations in terms of what we would like to see. Today is more of a free flow of expressions, opinions, discussion, and our first meeting, I think if we can help shape up, you know, for the next meeting, some other issues, perhaps we can come back at the next meeting with some more formal recommendations from each member. Any thoughts on that? Any disagreement? Diane, any other comments? Or?
No.
All right. Mark? Yes.
I just, for the sake of having some factual information to understand some of the things we're talking about, I just wanted to mention one little thing more about the national level, that these national organizations realize that changes can't be made overnight. This standard, this principle about saving abandoned animals who are healthy and treatable and finding them homes, the national standard is a 90 to 91% live release rate now. That's the goal. There are shelters and in Connecticut that are above that, for instance, and then there are shelters that are well below that. The national funding wouldn't demand an immediate turnaround. The national funding wants to recognize a commitment toward creating programs in a step-by-step fashion that would increase that live release rate, that would increase the commitment to healthy and treatable animals being adopted, and they do so, as we would imagine many grant funding organizations do, through keeping statistics through transparency, through reports, all of which could be standardized. And then there's actually further reward. This also I found to be true with what I call the benevolent donors, the private donors who give to the cause of animal welfare, by and large only give when they see that same commitment to saving animals rather than euthanizing them as a matter of animal control management, if you will. But it is considered to be a step-by-step process, and therefore I think we also at the state level can help the municipalities understand that and understand that they're all in different places, but it's a matter of being proactive and programmatic in their approach. And then I think a world of opportunity opens up.
Do you know, because I know for myself, I had checked into a couple national organizations to help us with some situations that we had, but one of their requirements were that you were a 501c3, which the municipal facilities are not. So
right.
Where does that help us?
Great. Through the establishment of the similar accords, which embraced the non-profit organizations as well. Maddie's Fund, for instance, and most national organizations are falling in line with Maddie's Funds, do not make the 501c3 stipulation. So all, in fact, there are various categories in which the shelters fall into, a traditional shelter and other categories, but it's all shelters, especially the public shelters, the municipal shelters, are encouraged through Maddie's Fund and the similar ones, and they indicate that where they come together is the indication of the commitment to the similar accords. And the similar accords, again, is this basic acknowledgement of committing to save healthy and treatable animals. So luckily, that's changed, and I think necessarily we as a task force would want to focus on Maddie's Fund and the other organizations that are there primarily for the municipal shelters.
Okay. I would like...
Ray,
yes, Ray, I'm sorry. Go right ahead.
Yeah, I just... not to throw a stick in the spokes at this point, because the momentum is so good, but I just... You know, you're talking about treatable animals that are unhealthy animals for placement. The whole... animal control, just to give you a little background, animal control is about the control of rabies, is how it started. And when it's animal control first started, I mean, we have old newspaper articles in our office that in the city of New Haven. Dogs caught without a collar were shot on sight. That's how it started. And it was for control of rabies. Animal control officers, their first and foremost job is not only animal welfare, but also public safety. So what we have to keep in mind is that not every animal is adoptable. So as we move forward with this, we have to also start thinking about getting people trained in behavioral assessment of animals.
Absolutely.
So that they're not making off-the-hip decisions on, you know, that dog's no good. And we were talking earlier about, you know, sometimes once you take a dog out of the kennel, it's a whole different dog.
Right.
And I think that's important that we have to keep that in mind, but not every animal is going to be placeable, and you know that's something that that's a hard fact, but unfortunately that's the whole idea is to protect the public, and unfortunately you know some of the municipal shelters in this state have taken it upon themselves to make themselves no kill and have placed out dangerous dogs, and the municipalities are currently in litigation because of that, because some people got seriously hurt,
right,
because of some very dangerous animals that were put out there in the public. So we have to keep that in mind when we're moving forward with this. But I think that, you know, behavioral assessment is a big, big deal. And when we're talking about changing the regulations, an area for the general public outside of the kennel to observe dogs for adoption and things like that, I think that's a big thing. Also, you know, dogs that are placeable, I mean, you can't expect the municipality to hold dogs for a year in a kennel. First of all, it's not healthy for the animal.
Right.
So, you know, again, that works in with foster groups and and animal welfare groups that they should work hand in hand with the municipal shelters to get these animals out of the shelters as soon as they can, get them into a different environment, and get them placed into new homes. But,
absolutely. This is what you just said is a segue to just everything else on our list. It really relates, which is why it's so important that these other items are on the list as well.
Right.
Exactly.
Yeah. Very good. Good feedback, Raymond. Thank you. All right, so I'd like to entertain a motion to on item number one to accept A, Ray is going to be sending us a list of shelters to Deborah's point in question, and B, the task force will come back with some formalized recommendations or at least some recommendations for our next meeting on item number one. Can I entertain a motion?
So moved.
Second.
We have a motion. We have a second. Any other discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion passes. Thank you. Okay, let's take a look at item number two on page 5 of 7, and that's existing education and training standards for animal control officers on current license laws. So perhaps to start this discussion, Diane and Ray can give us kind of an overview. Raymond, go right ahead.
Actually, Diane's laughing because she knows what I went through. It took me 15 years to get mandated animal control officer training done. In 2012, we finally got it passed. And in the past, anybody could be an animal control officer. And that's where we got back into the old dog words. Now what we require is anybody new that comes on has to have a minimum of 80 hours of instruction. So what we have teamed up with the National Animal Control and Care Association, and through their training academy, which covers everything from constitutional law to animal behavior to animal handling to feeding and caring to first aid, they go through that academy and they have to pass that academy. I know Diane's been through it. I've been through it. It's not playtime. It's you study at night, and it's not an easy thing to pass. And then they also have to have additional 5 hours with me on the Connecticut laws and what's required of them in the state of Connecticut. And then any existing animal control officers have to have a minimum of 6 hours of mandated training, work-related training, every year. Every year there's an animal control officers training conference. They just had it last week, actually. A lot of them attend that. A lot of them, especially the part-timers, are doing courses online, a lot of webinars from the ASPCA or Maddie's Fund or anybody, AHA, anybody that is offering anything like that. Connecticut Humane Society has stepped up and done a couple of courses, training courses for animal control officers. But what it's doing is we're seeing, and Diane could concur with me on this, is we're seeing new life being brought into animal control. I mean, I spoke at the conference last week, and I've been at this 30 years, but I look out in the audience and all I see is new people, which is good. Because of this training, what we had seen in the last 2 years is a lot of retirements or people that have left that were the old dog catchers. You know, they just picked the dogs up, threw them in the pound, 7 days, put them down. That was it. That's how they operated. So we're seeing that going away, and we got a whole new generation of people coming in, and I'm very excited about that. But when we get to this part about number two, you know, I don't have the list in front of me of the curriculum, but that's something that we could discuss and see if there's something that maybe we want to add to that curriculum for the animal control officer training, mandate that into their initial training. So.
I know I do agree with everything that Ray did say, because there were people in the job of animal control that really shouldn't have been in the job of animal control. And then, you know, there still is now, but I think that the training is weeding those people out. And it gives us an opportunity to review the things that we're doing, come up with new ways, because there's always new things that you can do. And if we're hiding out in our little shelter and we're not taught those things that are happening in California, since California is the one that usually brings out the new thing, and they bring them out our way, it helps us. And it also gives us a new spirit, because animal control is a tough job to do, and it can be very sad and depressing sometimes. So it kind of gives us a new spirit and a new look of things.
From the perspective of the Chief Humane Commissioner in New Haven, one of the most exciting bits of news I received a couple years ago now was the initiation of this training program. And I consider this the first step in this new chapter of heightened concern about animal welfare in the state. It is just in all regards a really wonderful and positive thing to occur. I'm personally so grateful for it. The city of New Haven is grateful for it. And it is doing, I've observed in my work and especially my conversations with other shelters and even organizations associated with those shelters, seeing the difference as well. And it is refocusing those in this field to be there and to keep up with the standards and practice, best practices of humane welfare across the board. And my only hope going forward is to add potentially more training in evaluation in the modern, in a more insightful means of evaluating these animals. But I think this is an incredibly positive step for the state of Connecticut.
Deborah? So as far as item number two, I would like to kind of formalize this into a motion. And I'd like to entertain a motion so that we, and maybe with Ray and Diane's help in particular, entertain a motion so that we can come back at the next meeting with some suggested language to augment the existing legislation that we have based on some of Ray's thoughts and Diane and some of the other members. And we look to formalize that for the future. But for the sake of today, I'd like to ask for a motion to accept some language for the commission members to come back with some language, Ray and Diane in particular, to augment the existing legislation. Can I have a motion on that?
So moved.
And I'll second.
We have a motion and we have a second. Is there any other discussion? Hearing none, we'll call for the vote. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Thank you. Motion passes. And thank you, Ray. Diane, for your help in that. Item number three, rules and regulations regarding the penalties for abuse. Let's have a discussion on that.
Brandon. Okay. We actually, just this past year, or year before last, we are now one of the states in the nation that made animal abuse a felony. We still have misdemeanor animal abuse in the state, but any person that has subsequently committed the same act and was found guilty on the first act, it is now a felon in the state. Animal fighting, any person that maliciously or intentionally harms an animal, those are all felonies and always have been. So I think that we're moving in the right direction. I don't think that we should have an all-felony animal cruelty law, and the reason being is a lot of times, and actually there's another task force that I'm on about hoarding, we go into these animal hoarding situations, and these people, you know, it's a mental illness with these people, but sometimes the only way you can get them into the system is to go ahead and arrest them, and then you get court-mandated help that they need. But to charge them with a felony because, you know, an 86-year-old woman has 90 cats in her house, that to me, that's not right. The woman shouldn't be charged with a felony. The whole idea is just with the misdemeanor charges to get her through the system and get her going. And this was discussed during our hoarding task force also. So I think that our animal cruelty laws are good. I think they're strong. We use them a lot, especially in my department. Maybe I could hear from the judicial on it and what they think. I know that I would not mind listening to a couple of state's attorneys to see what they have to say about it. especially one in particular that Diane and I both know from Danielson, Bonnie Bentley, who's quite an advocate, not only with children, but with animal cases. I think our statute's strong. I think our animal cruelty statute is strong, especially with anybody that is a constant violator, that they're now, it's now a felony. And I think that is a huge step to stop people from continually doing that.
I agree pretty much with Ray. The only thing I think I don't agree with is that we need to put a little more clarification in some of the statute. Proper shelter, I think it should probably be defined a little bit better. Because it's kind of hard if you're out there and they have a picnic table for the dog to lay under, and they say, well, that's shelter, you know. So I just think there's a few things in there that could be defined a little bit better.
To answer your question, your comment about the proper shelter, what it says is adequate protection from the weather. And what you have to remember is that the animal cruelty statute is not just about dogs in somebody's yard or cats, that it also concerns livestock and animals, you know, large animals. And in order to open that up and to go ahead and make changes and define what would be proper shelter for each species of animal that that we practice animal husbandry with is, I think it's just too large of a thing. I mean, to generalize it, it doesn't work for everything. So you can't say, you know, three sides with a roof, you know, when somebody has 300 cows out in a field and they could get into a tree line and get out of the weather. And believe it or not, a lot of animals, large animals, will prefer to be out in the weather than to be stuffed into a barn, and sometimes it's healthier for them than to be in a barn. So that's something that you have to remember. It's just not about dogs when you're talking about the animal cruelty statute. There's a lot of animals that covers.
Feedback on this, that one of the more troubling things that I see in municipalities today, and we go through it a lot down in Southern Connecticut, is varying forms of animal cruelty. We see publicized a lot of the more onerous forms of cruelty, but yet when someone drops off into woods where there's coyotes and raccoons, a cat and her kittens, that really troubles me. Or, like Mayor Jackson and I in Hamden had, where a group of pit bull puppies were dropped off in an open parking lot. I think that is a disgrace. So I'd be curious to know, with the statute the way it's worded, what are the penalties for the more publicized animal abuse versus what I just described, right?
Actually, what you described falls underneath the abandonment part of the statute, which is a misdemeanor. You know, maybe parts of that statute could be put into the felony, first count felony. You know, maybe it's something that we could look at in that direction is something that, you know, where a person has confined an animal and allowed it to do harm to itself or other animals, or put it in a situation that will allow harm to be done to that animal. I think that maybe that's wanton neglect, and maybe that's something that should be shifted into the felony category.
Trying to prove who abandoned the mother cat and the kittens.
Yep.
Who abandoned the pit bull puppies in the parking lot. How can you prosecute that if you don't know who did it? You know, these kind of people do that most of the time when people aren't around.
Just to add that this is such a difficult topic, and my experience is that the feeling is that we do have some of the strictest and best laws in this state, but that they're not enforced well. And I think, unfortunately, this is where we find the biggest disconnect between the general public and animal control, if you will. And I'm speaking especially from the point of view in New Haven, where, and I understand the need for some of these to be sort of described generally, but the general description can allow for a lot of interpretation, and there'll be a particular situation where the public is interpreting that generality in one way, and the animal control officer is interpreting it in a much different way, and you get a battle between the two, which is, in the end, never serves the animal well, actually, I found. This isn't a critique, it's simply an observation, and it shows how complex this particular category is, and that it's one I think we... Any kind of standard, any kind of definition, more description to help guide both the public and animal control and all those interested into better common ground is important. There is, of course, in these situations, there's always that visceral reaction that you just see an animal in a certain circumstance and have a visceral reaction and then expect a certain response to that. And the public will be very upset when animal control's response doesn't seem to be as humane and caring as possible. The public also can make demands that are unreasonable and illegal. So there's both sides of it. But I think just to acknowledge up front that the way these felonies and these misdemeanors are sort of enforced is also going to be part of the issue.
Enforcement sometimes is hard. And I'm sure Ray can attest to that, because a lot of times the animal control officers will bring something into the courts and the courts will go, oh, it's just an animal thing, we're going to nolly it and be done with it. So it frustrates the animal control officer because, well, everything I try to do according to the law, well, they don't have time to deal with this. They've got this, that, and the other thing to deal with instead. And that animals, again, as just as you had said about in the towns, the animal control facilities are the bottom of the list. Well, it's the same in the courts, too.
In fact, not to be exclusive and to include all representation, I should also add to my comments that the judicial side of it, and often there is a disappointment on behalf of the general public on how finally it's handled at that level. That we had one in New Haven a couple years ago, an animal abuse case that a fairly well-known one that ended with the animal being strangled and tortured. There was a very active group promoting this cause and basically pleading that the highest form of penalty be enacted, and it turned out to be the lowest form of penalty, and that's incredibly discouraging for all of us who care about animals from whatever position.
Deborah.
Trying to figure out how to put it without getting myself in trouble. I think this area is certainly one that's pretty controversial, and probably work could be done on all sides. I would say that in the broader context of the criminal statutes, not just regarding animals, strengthening penalties does not always have exactly the effect that you want, because sometimes the officers or whoever is enforcing it, if they feel that the penalty is too on the front line is too strict, they might not actually arrest the person. So sometimes that backfires. I think increasing understanding is always good. The case that you talked about actually did not have as bad as an outcome as you thought, but it was confidential at the end, so we couldn't tell what it was. So I think that being overly influenced by public opinion and outcry isn't always good. Mm-hmm. Certainly you want to take that into consideration, but there are many aspects, and it's pretty complicated, sometimes more than people know.
Deb, do you think then that you, because there's some really good points here, and Diane made a very good point, it's difficult to enforce, and I understand your perspective about what you just mentioned, but Do you think that in the cases that I mentioned, that tighter laws and an education of what those tighter laws are, would that act as a deterrent from preventing that from happening again? So it's not so much in the, it'll end up being in the enforcement, but if there was a clear illustration and a clear identification of what the tighter laws are, Ray, in terms of moving from a misdemeanor to a felony, and an education process, would that be a deterrent, do you think?
I'm not really sure. I mean, I think that certainly that is the theory behind stricter laws, that they deter behavior. Mm-hmm. I personally, my personal opinion is that that's part of, that's one piece, but certainly another piece is public education and different attitudes. And I think that, you know, certainly attitudes about animals, care of animals, what's acceptable has evolved over the years. Mm-hmm. And maybe not with everyone, so I certainly don't think, and there are, so I think that it's complicated, and that's one piece.
Any other comments on that? Raymond?
Just one comment. What I'm seeing from, you know, when I started my career back in 1984 and what I'm seeing today in 2014 is that the judicial system is really taking animal cases very seriously now. You know, for we had a gentleman that from Hamden for a horse abuse case. They put a $600,000 bond on this gentleman. I mean, that's more than they do for somebody that kills somebody. We had, you know, Bridgeport Court. We've had good outcomes there. We have a case in Danbury Court right now that is working diligently with us. Danielson, I mean, they're a godsend for animal cases. You know, Bantam Court especially. I mean, they love to see our animal cases come in. I think it breaks up the monotony of the other ones, but they do. They take every case seriously now, and from when I started in 1984 and what Diane said, you know, they just kind of took the cases and thrown them aside. And the reason that was, a lot of that was, is because the animal control officers were not trained properly. They were submitting poor reports, if any reports, with their infractions or with their summons paperwork. A lot of them did not know how to do warrants or anything to get anything done properly. So, you know, with this new generation coming in and with people that in my career as I was coming up where state's attorneys are now Superior Court judges, they have a better understanding of what's going on in the animal community. And I think it's actually working much better than it was. So I think the progression is there. And it's not going to happen overnight, but the progression is there, and that's the most important thing.
Well, I think we have we've made the motion. We've acted on the motion to add to or augment existing, looking at the statutes and adding some other language and some components. So with that being said, let's take a look and move to item number 4. The development of a system to track persons who have been convicted of animal abuse in order to prevent such persons from acquiring animals from shelters in other municipalities or states. So let's kick off that discussion. Raymond.
Okay, you always come to me first. That's why I'm behind you. If I remember correctly, I think this was actually brought up in this past session about having an animal abuse registry. And I don't remember what happened with the bill itself directly or what killed the bill. I think mostly what it was who was going to keep the registry and have be able to keep it updated on people that were convicted of animal cruelty. You know, we have that website that's out there at petabuse.com, but they put everything under there, and it's not accurate. There's people that were given probation for cases and accelerated rehabilitation where their record is expunged after they complete their probationary time, which is up to 2 years. So a lot of that information isn't current. So I think the biggest problem with this is who is going to keep the registry and who's going to keep it updated. You know, what agency is it going to end up with? Because it's going to have to end up with a state agency, whether it's the state police, like they have the sexual offender registry. It's going to end up somewhere in public safety. I'm almost positive that that's where something like this will end up.
Well, you know, our if you actually were convicted, you would be in the judicial branch. Actually, you could go on our website and find convictions. The issue is really for people who get the diversionary programs, AR, or other forms, that those would not be, those would be wiped off the record. So I guess I'm having a little bit of an issue with convicted. If you're only looking for convicted, you might want to actually, I don't know if we want to stick with that or not, because you might want, I mean, what you're talking about here is to prevent people from acquiring animals from shelters. So it's not, you know, you could say, even if you got AR for something, maybe you shouldn't be able to do that. I mean, you're not, it's not additional jail time or something like that. There's no legal barrier, I don't think, to saying that. So I think it would have to be something outside in the judicial system, because we wouldn't have any of those. We would only have things that were technically a conviction.
Yeah, yes. We'll go to Ray, and then Mark will come back to you. Okay. Ray.
Thank you. I just more or less have a question. As if somebody is given AR and their record is expunged, so any history of any past criminal activity would be gone. Because we have to expunge our records, and just like the state police have to expunge theirs when somebody has completed AR, there could be no record of this anywhere. So to have them on a list is more or less blacklisting them, for lack of a better term. And I kind of have a problem with that, actually.
Any other thoughts?
Just a comment and perhaps a question to add to the discussion, that in New Haven, where the ACO is a member of the police department, what he does is, with any potential adopter, he has access to police records and will essentially do kind of the background check on the person. That's a matter of course. So that at least there's that kind of information supplied about every potential adopter. My question is that something that happens in all the shelters in Connecticut, or is that just the choice of the particular shelter? Diane.
Most of the animal control officers are
not
police officers, so don't have access to that type of information.
That's my question. Have access to that?
No.
Yeah. So I think that's one thing to acknowledge a difference. The same municipal shelters, if they have a member of the police force as an ACO, does have access to those records, but the many who don't have an ACO who is a member of the police force wouldn't have access to those sorts of records. So it's an inconsistency on this matter throughout the state.
I think it's a very important topic, because we all know that whether it's domestic abuse, child abuse, or animal abuse, there's a direct link among at least those three. And these links spread out to other areas also. So this is something that we really want to try to get right. And I just want to entertain any other discussion on this. Diane, do you have anything else on that?
Ray, do you want to say anything on the cross-reporting?
Yeah, actually, it goes into effect today, actually, the new part of the law. Whenever an animal control officer suspects animal cruelty, they have to report that information to the Commissioner of Agriculture. We've actually developed forms for the animal control officers to make it easier for them. It has to be given to the Commissioner of Agriculture within 48 hours, and it's everything from who's responsible for the animal, the address, and all that. And that information is then forwarded to DCF, and what they do is cross-reference that information with any cases that they may have going, so that we could hopefully stop any incidents, not only with the animals, but also with any children that may be in the house. And it works both ways, that if DCF sees an issue with animals in a house, they, of course, would notify us directly, the Department of Agriculture, and we would investigate any potential animal abuse in that house. And like the chairman was saying, that, you know, there is a huge correlation between animal abuse and domestic abuse and child abuse, and hopefully by this cross-reporting bill that thank you to Representative Urban for her work on this, is hopefully put a stop to this, and you know, maybe Connecticut will be one of the leading states in the country to show other states what needs to be done to stop this type of violence. All right, I'm done.
So we have, as I see it, kind of two issues here. Is a formalization of an actual animal abuse registry, Ray, which is kind of amorphous right now. There's really nothing there. And then who and what agency would administer it? So we all realize it's very important. Deborah?
A third point, who would be on it? I guess that was what Ray was
and
talking about.
And who would be on it? And, Ray, it's your thought that, just to Deborah's point, is it your thought that after the AR is completed that they come off the registry? Is that what you were saying earlier?
Well, they wouldn't even be on the registry until they would never be on the registry, not even during their AR.
Okay.
But should they be?
They're not convicted at that point. They're doing probation. It's a probationary period, and it's to allow first-time offenders to have no record of anything. We do see a lot of animal abuse cases end up in AR, but most of them are, you know, the animal hoarding people, or you know, somebody didn't feed their dog, or you know, it's not the big cases, the huge cases. You know, I really don't know what the answer is going to be to this on how you're going to get this registry up and going and who's going to be on it, but I think it's something that is going to have to be worked through judicial and possibly working through through public safety and see if something can be put together for this. I don't. Do you know of any other states that have any type of registry?
That was my next question.
Yeah.
I think that's one of the things we could investigate. If nothing specific comes to mind, but to see if they do. Yeah.
Deborah, did you have a point?
I was just, if you're going with convictions, it is up there for a certain period of time. The convictions are up there for a lengthy period of time. So you could look a person up, even on the judicial branch website, our public website, and if it's a conviction, it would show up. So I don't know, if you're only going with convictions, you might not need the registry, although, I mean, that would only be in-state. You might want something national for out-of-state, and that would be a, I guess you certainly wouldn't want to have to search every other state before you let somebody adopt.
So that point right there, how about if we contemplate this? This is going to be a very a discussion that's going to continue to move forward in these next series of meetings that we have. So I'd like to suggest that we consider maybe the motion here is to at least come back, we put in the form of a motion, an analysis of what states have an animal abuse registry. So I'd like to entertain, well, let me open that up before. That's just a thought. Anybody have any other thoughts on that? Greg.
Yeah, actually, I'm jumping ahead. I'm kind of looking at number 5, standards of evaluation of potential adopters. I mean, that could kind of be placed in with, you know, whatever your application process is going to be for potential adopters as to what their past history is with animals. And, you know, that may help with number 4, I think.
Okay. Mark?
Also, just to keep in mind that this is a potential area of regional cooperation. In other words, in New England, we're pretty close together, and certainly there are adopters adopting Connecticut animals who live in New York, New Hampshire, Massachusetts, Rhode Island. We have that in New Haven all the time. So this is a potential area where we could, again, share resources and collaborate with our neighboring states.
Right. Another point.
You know, we're talking about animals that just come out of this registry for animals that come out of municipal shelters. But what we have to remember is that close to 14,000 animals are imported into Connecticut every year from other states that are coming in. I mean, you go online and adopt a dog. So, you know, the point of the registry is that to stop adoptions, they're just going to go somewhere else. They'll get them online and dropped right off in a commuter lot somewhere on a Saturday afternoon.
Although, but the state, of course, has tried to make strict or tighten up the regulations regarding bringing animals into
right,
the
but it still
state as well.
It still doesn't stop people.
Yeah, no,
from,
well,
I mean,
yeah.
That's the only reason I have that number is because we required, that's the number that was reported to
that's
us.
That's reported,
so,
yeah.
I'm sure it's higher than that.
All right, so can we entertain a motion to have us do research to come back with a list of those states that have an animal abuse registry, and as part of that research, we can maybe make a determination what agency within that state is administering that. Is there a motion? Motion by Paula. Is there a
second?
Is there okay, second. Now, any other discussion on this? Deborah.
Is that information that some of the members have or could get easily, or is there any possibility of having OLI look into that? I don't know. Are there any legislators on there that can utilize OLR? I'm not sure.
Well, now, I had made arrangements to have Connecticut Conference of Municipalities here today. They also will act as an extension and an arm for us to do research. Their research database, though, is primarily in-state issues, but I can also talk to them about doing the out-of-state research. So are we comfortable with that? That we have the two?
I think OLR probably could do it if we are able to use them as a resource stream. I think they could probably come up with it, the Office of Legislative Research.
Okay. So then can we have Planning and Development help us with that for the next meeting? Excellent. So, okay. So then that's the motion. To have the Office of Legislative Administration come forward with us to the next meeting with a list of states who have an animal abuse registry, and if we can get it, what agency within the state manages it. So that's the motion. Can I have a motion for that? Okay.
You just replaced it.
Replaced it with Office of Legislative Administration. So a resource. Paula, you made the motion, right?
Okay.
So we have a motion, and we have a second by Raymond.
Correct.
Any other discussion? Good insight, good option. We'll call for the motion to be approved. All those in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion passes. Thank you for your help on that. Very much appreciated. Okay. Item number 5, the establishment of standards for such shelters to use when evaluating potential adopters for such animals. I'll kick off this part of the discussion by saying that one of the things that many of us have seen all across Connecticut is this level and layer of fragmentation. There's so many different groups out there. There's so many fosters, adopters, people who are doing rescue, so many other agencies. And one of the dilemmas is that there's not a lot of cohesiveness sometimes. There's a wide range of opinion on fosters, on adopters. So how do we formulate this? Thoughts, please. Raymond?
All right, I'll go first. Actually, I was the former executive director of Windham County Humane Society in Dummerston, Vermont. So I have experience working with a private shelter. And what I notice is in New England, actually, we're the only state that doesn't have a Humane Federation. There's Vermont Humane Federation, there's New Hampshire, there's New England Federation of Humane Societies, which I was president of for 2 years. But Connecticut, for some reason, they just can't get the act together. We're the only state in New England that does not require any registry of private organizations in this state outside of animal importers. Whereas the other states do. They have their federations, which get them all together for quarterly meetings or whatever, so that they all work together. And they do. They work very well together. When I was in Vermont, it was amazing how well everybody worked together. I don't know if it can be done. I know that my good friend Sandy Monteros from the ASPCA has tried and failed at it. Not her personally, but the group as a whole. The group got up and running, and then it just fell apart because of personality conflicts. And, you know, you're not doing it the right way, my way is the right way, and But I think, you know, what number five, I think what we're looking at is to come up with a standardized adoption application, I think, is what we're looking for the municipalities, is to come up with a standardized form for everybody so that, you know, they have to have this kind of information. They have to do the background check with the veterinarian to make sure that that person is a potentially good home for that animal so that the animal doesn't end up back on the street or back in the shelter or end up in Diane's town because it got dumped off on the side of the road because somebody didn't want it.
I agree completely with Ray on this, and I actually see this being not an insurmountable task in front of us. There are many really quality application forms that exist that we can survey. Again, there are resources at the national level as well that have these guidelines laid out. I think there, in other words, are plenty of models available. In many cases, it's just going to be nuanced distinctions between how they're done, and in some cases it will be more blatant. But I think at least there's general agreement. Most animal welfare organizations, rescues and shelters alike that do adoption, do seem at this point to agree on the basic things. I think it's a matter of ensuring things at the next level. I'm optimistic that we could come up with that sort of statewide adoption form.
Any other comments? Thoughts? Let me ask this question. Is the next step on this to do a survey and research on what some of the other models are out there for us to consider for the next meeting?
And I would suggest also including, not that you suggest you were excluding this, but some of the rescues as well, just to see what sort of standards and you know, they're following in their forms. I work with rescues as well. I think we're going to find a lot of compatibility, but to include some of their policies and procedures regarding adoption as well.
Any other thoughts? Paul?
Correct me if I'm wrong. There are no standards for rescues or fosters or anything as it stands now?
That's correct, unless they import animals into Connecticut.
So the only requirement is if they cross state lines, there is something they have to follow.
That's right.
So there's really no way of knowing how many are just Facebook pages without anything behind them.
We're finding a lot of them are Facebook pages that are not even in Connecticut, but
okay.
Say they are. And even on Pet Finder, we're finding people that say they're from Shelton and come to find out they're from Missouri.
So that's an excellent observation. Well, thank you for bringing that up. Because then the question is, because of that, does that adversely affect this motion? We made the motion to do the research, but we have that. I'm not sure our research would be that accurate in the end, Mark.
I think it could be if we go by virtue of the rescues that we have relationships, trusted relationships with. And certainly in New Haven, for instance, we build those relationships. I think probably most of us could recommend those rescues that we trust.
So would it be fosters, rescuers, and adopters? Three categories?
There probably aren't any fostering agencies that I know of. They usually fostering is done through the rescue. So we can sort of lump that together as one, and we'll get to fostering down here.
Okay.
In sort of New Haven, all we're left with in an initial question is, are you at least 501c3, you know, a non-registered as a nonprofit? And Ray, both of you know that a lot of them aren't. You don't go to that trouble. We consider that a baseline criterion. You at least have had to fill out the paperwork. But that still doesn't guarantee. You can be a nonprofit and slip under the radar in many, many ways. But, again, if we recommend from our knowledge base the rescues that are proven and trustworthy. I think we can rely on what they provide as models.
Any other comments? Deborah?
Sounds good to me.
Okay. So let's try to put this in the form of a motion, and help me with this if it's incorrect, please. I'd like to formulate a motion, entertain a motion for us to do some research on what models are out there in other parts of the country, across the United States, other states, regarding rescues and adopters.
Adoption policy, maybe? Or
application.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Okay.
Yes, very good.
All right. So let's kind of shape this motion.
Yeah.
Putting together a motion to do the research on what models and adoption policies are out there for adopters and rescuers. Help me with that. Mm-hmm. How do we formulate that?
Adoption applications, not policies.
Adoption applications.
Right, just applications, yeah. Do you want me to make that motion,
yes,
please?
Yes, go ahead.
Okay. I move that we as a committee look into other applications that other rescue groups, and not only within the state of Connecticut but outside the state of Connecticut, or national organizations, to look at their adoption applications and use those for consideration for Connecticut.
I'd like to second that.
Okay. So we have a motion. We have a second. Any other discussion? Paul, any? Deborah? Okay. Okay, hearing none, I'd like to call for the vote. Are all those in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Okay, motion passes. Oh, that's something, yes, that's part of the motion.
I'll be in Oregon next week, so I'll gather stuff from them.
All right, we're on item number seven.
Six.
So the establishment of rules and responsibilities for volunteer groups that work with such shelters and animal control officers. And in talking to Ray yesterday, he has a great deal of positive and negative experience with this. Raymond?
Okay. First of all, I don't think that this should be at the state level, as to tell municipalities who they can or cannot allow into their facilities. I think it's up to each individual municipality to set their own rules and responsibilities for volunteers to work in not only their shelters, but, you know, in any capacity in any municipal facility. They're the ones that are going to hold the liability if somebody gets hurt in those facilities. If they're not going to come back to the state and say, well, the state told me I have to do this. The liability is still going to fall back on the municipality. There's things going on in other parts of the state with the volunteer groups where it basically has become a free-for-all, and the municipality has lost control of their facility, and they're working to correct that. But I think one way we could address this is that we require the municipality to have a volunteer coordinator if they're going to have volunteers in their facility. So that you don't have those problems. You have somebody that's actually in charge without putting that extra burden onto an animal control officer that has enough to do.
Mark, do you mind me asking a question? Is the volunteer?
Who would qualify as a volunteer coordinator? Does that come from the organization or the municipality?
That would be a municipal employee.
That's, yeah, thank you for clarifying.
Diane?
Would it be an employee or another volunteer?
It would have to be an employee. Somebody that has the interest of the municipality in mind.
If I may, I that's what I've experienced to be a major problem is you have the municipality, and then you have the volunteer group, which is a privately run 501c3 nonprofit, which is not accountable to the municipality directly, and as the Humane Commissioner of New Haven, this is definitely an issue. I'm actually excited over the recommendation of a volunteer coordinator from the municipality's point of view. I think that would go a long way to bridge the gap and ensure the municipality itself isn't being left out of the equation, which is incredibly important.
Diane, how do you see that?
I totally agree, because as Ray said, the volunteers, sometimes they like to take over the municipality, and then the animal control officer has no control.
It's a very important topic of discussion, because even down in North Haven, Hamden, to talk about a personal story, Mayor of Hamden and I were working with volunteer groups, and the mayor called me in to try to help him placate one of the groups, because the group became so unwieldy that they tried to dictate policies and procedures to the animal control facility. And that, as Ray and Diane know, and everyone here knows, that doesn't play too well at the local level, at the local shelter level. So, as a thought, to continue the discussion, in all of our municipalities, we have a park and recreation department or a community services department. Could that department, let's say park and rec, who's out there in the parks, out there through the community, be someone where the local coordinator could work with the volunteers? I don't think we can get someone realistically from the police department. I don't know if the animal can, if in our case in North Haven we have assistant ACOs, they're out there. I don't think they can do it. So the question is, within the municipality, what department could aid the animal control facility? Mark, I thought you were going to say something. Then Ray, I'll come back to you.
Yeah, and with all due respect, I agree it probably shouldn't be someone from the ACO community. You need someone actually directly representing the mayor or the first selectman, but that's as far as that thought's going, just to agree with you on that.
It's a tough one.
And it may mean, asking some mayors and what they think.
Right.
Even in the private sector, in private shelters, they have volunteer coordinators, and that's actually a profession. That's what these people do. It's just not, the guy that moves the parks is going to, okay, I need you to organize these volunteers. That's not going to work. You need somebody that has in their resume that this is what they do. They know how to do this.
Right. Well, in fact, this is, am I cutting you off? I'm sorry.
Well, I just want to clarify. I don't want you to think I'm anti-volunteers and shelters. I think volunteers are great. When I had ran the Humane Society up in Vermont, if it wasn't for volunteers, the place would have never operated.
Yeah. Yeah.
Their resources and knowledge are invaluable, and they immensely help municipal shelters and take a lot of burden off of animal control officers. We just had the law passed a couple of years ago that now we could allow volunteers to post animals online for animal control officers for animals for adoption to help them get them on PetFinder, because a lot of animal control officers didn't even know what PetFinder was.
Right.
So,
right.
That was a big plus. So volunteers have helped a lot. But you get incidences in some municipalities that get out of hand, and unfortunately you need somebody that's going to be able to coordinate the whole issue. And it has to be somebody that knows how to do this, that it's in their resume. Yes, I have this experience. We could reach out to some of the national organizations to see what they have for guidelines for volunteer coordinators.
Exactly. That's sort of the scenario I'm envisioning in my mind, just using New Haven. If I were to suggest to the mayor that we hire a volunteer coordinator on behalf of the city, I know the answer is going to be no. There are no resources. However, this is the sort of thing that the national organizations tend to look very favorably on funding, providing some funding to hire this type of person, at least to get that person started while a municipality can try to find the forces to the funding to commit. So I see that being actually very optimistic. And even donors. I know Laura Bourbon in Brantford, in her program, has donor-funded positions there. Yeah, and this I think is incredibly, urgently needed position, to tell you the truth, because it would keep the work that the volunteer groups that is so essential. It would keep it on the positive side and well coordinated, and help it not degenerate as we've seen it do.
One of the things we've seen, to Mark's point, is an effective volunteer network can really help the local animal control shelters and facilities in the category of kennel stress, exercising the animals, walking the animals, and that can go a very long way. Sometimes, however, some of the volunteers, they try to infiltrate into policies and procedures, and most animal control facilities across the state, as everyone knows, are under the auspices of the police department, and that doesn't fly. It doesn't play too well. So then, first of all, any other discussion on this? Great.
It's just not volunteer groups, but it's volunteer individuals also. There's a lot of individuals, retirees, that want something to do, and that's where a lot of shelters get their volunteers from. There's retirees that just come in for a couple hours a day, and actually it turns out a lot of them stay there 40 hours a week, but you need the person to coordinate that,
Absolutely.
I mean, if you have one group in a shelter and you got other people that want to come in and volunteer on a one-on-one basis, you need that coordinator to do that.
I think just a comment for the sake of this being our first meeting and having some basic information acknowledged. From my point of view, we basically ask animal control officers to do two jobs in one. Well, more than two jobs, but we ask them to do actual animal control and to manage that situation within the city or town limits. But we also ask them to be shelter managers as well, and to coordinate the administrative side and deal with all of that. That is a lot of responsibility, and then to have to be a volunteer organization manager as well. So finding staff to alleviate those multiple tasks and who can really be dedicated to this particular component of it, realizing in New Haven, our dogs would not get walked almost at all. And these are our adoptable dogs. If it weren't for the volunteers, we need to support that program. And I think this is a wonderful way to do it.
Paula? I'm sitting on the fence with this. Our shelter does not allow volunteers. They had a horrible experience, and once that happens, it is very difficult to try to get volunteers back in. So I'm all for defining an area that would help volunteers get back into the system, but knowing what it's caused in the past, I'm reluctant to make it the golden rule.
Well, actually, oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I don't think this is requiring that you have to have volunteers. I think this is just saying if you do, correct?
And in fact, one of the things I was thinking, backing up a step on this item, is that rather than the establishment of rules and responsibilities, could we make recommendations for those municipalities that don't know where to start or have to start over with a volunteer group? Is there any way we can draw on positive resources as guidelines to at least point the way so that they can start them up?
Right.
That's where we could reach out to the national organizations that, there's no sense reinventing the wheel if the information's already out there.
Exactly, and it is, yeah.
All right. I think we have a motion unfolding, but before we present a possible motion, in listening to Ray's point of view about the retirees and how they worked effectively, I couldn't help but think about, in some respects, it's like being a therapy dog for that person coming to the shelter.
Yeah, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So they come because it's a form of therapy for them. So there's an added advantage than listening to your point of view. It just dawned on me that really could be very effective. Mm-hmm. So any other discussion? Deborah, anything on this? Or? So the motion may be for today for us to consider is a motion to reach out to the national organizations to see what policies and models are out there regarding the volunteer networks. So can I entertain that motion? We have a motion.
So moved.
Okay, is there a second?
Sure.
Okay. So we have a motion. We have a so moved by Ray, second by Mark. All those in favor?
Oh, sorry.
Yes.
Sorry. Just a little further discussion. Yes. I just want to ask if this would be a time to add anything in about the suggested volunteer coordinator into our thoughts. I think it's a compelling idea.
So we're in discussion now regarding the motion and the second. So the question is, within this discussion, should one be bundled into the other, or should we start with just the research, or should we bundle it in as part of the motion? It's a good point.
You just make it an amendment.
I only bring it up because I think we could also research, do some research on this position, volunteer coordinator, at the same time.
Deborah?
No, I'm fine with that. If that's what it is, doing research on the position, yes.
Okay. Deborah, are you okay with also the research on the position? Because we're going to be amending the motion now. So.
Yes, I'm okay with researching whether they standards and whether people have volunteer coordinators. I would be uncomfortable with any recommendation about requiring volunteer, I think it will have a fiscal impact. So we'll talk about, I'm sure we'll have plenty of opportunities to talk about that.
So we're going to withdraw the first motion. Probably should have done that earlier on in the meeting and on another motion, but I'd like to withdraw take it off the table, the first motion. And Mark, if you'd be willing to make the second motion for us to vote on, to formulate it.
Ray, could you help me with that? Because it might be fresher in your mind. Because you had.
I don't know. It's going to be 59 next week, so it's not so fresh. All right, so we move that we reach out to the national organizations to see what policies and procedures they have for volunteer groups in shelter situations, and also look into if they have any outlines as to job descriptions for volunteer coordinators.
Perfect. Well, we have that. Yeah, we have that formulated. Did you hear that? Okay, very good. All right, so the motion's been made. Do we have a second?
Second.
We have a second. Any other discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Motion passes. Okay, number 7, the creation of a framework to coordinate the efforts of local humane organizations with volunteer groups, foster groups, and municipal and regional animal shelters. This kind of ties into what we were talking about earlier, about this level of fragmentation that's out there. So let's open this discussion up. Diane?
I think it's going to be difficult to do. As Ray said, it's been tried already. Not that we shouldn't try it again. Try again. I think that's all I really have to say about it.
Okay. Ray?
Actually, the door is open on this. 22-332E, Regional Municipal Dog Pound Contract, with the animal rescue organizations for veterinary treatment of injured, sick, or diseased animals, contract requirements, Department of Agriculture complaint, maintenance, list of rescue organizations. Municipal shelters are now required to keep a list of organizations that will help them in the event that dogs need medical care. So this has opened the door to that communication between these organizations and the municipal shelters. But to go back, what I was saying earlier is we really don't know what organizations are out there because we don't require any type of registration of them in the state of Connecticut. So if we had such a registration, then we would know exactly who the players are.
What statute was that?
22-332E, as in Edward.
So then we need to require first the registration of these organizations in order to do that.
It would be helpful. Is it a requirement? I don't think so. But
no, it isn't a requirement, but I'm wondering if we should make it a requirement.
It would be helpful. I mean, at least put in a minimum requirement that they are a 501 and registered with public charities from consumer protection.
Couple things. In New Haven, the shelter will often work with trusted rescues, and from time to time, you know, they take mostly dogs, but sometimes cats off our hands. The New Haven shelter builds. We build a relationship with those fosters. They are trusted. They are all 501c3. That's a baseline requirement for that. Also, we have, I guess you could call it somewhat of a pilot program in New Haven that the Humane Commission initiated. We're informally calling the Shoreline Animal Alliance. And it is simply bringing to the table, inviting to Humane Commission meetings from time to time, once every 1 or 2 months, representatives of other of area shelters and rescues and animal advocacy organizations to share ideas, resources, concerns. The next time we're doing this will be to discuss fostering, for instance, just the fostering philosophy, the fostering mentality. We're doing this in part to raise our profile for national funding, because this is an expectation of a place, for instance, like Maddie's Fund, that again wants to see a community collaboration, wants to see the shelter community working with the rescues, working with other advocacy groups. We had our first meeting of the Animal Alliance over the summer, and it was incredibly positive and was a significant step to breaking down the sort of isolation. We had the ACO. You were there. Mike was there. Of course, Paula was there. We had the ACO from Brantford there, former ACO from Bridgeport, and all just discussing what we do, what we face, and that sort of coming together in a non-threatening way and being kind of topic-specific, I think can yield some positive results, at least at first.
Well, I know of one organization that is a 501c3 that can really help in the form of trap, spay, and release, in terms of cats, as an example, to help control the feral cat population across Connecticut. In all of our municipalities, it's a growing, growing problem. So, as we look at this and contemplate number 7, the question is, do we try to have a requirement to have them registered as 501c3s? Is that a realistic goal to put together? Thoughts?
There are some very successful rescue groups that cannot afford to go through the 501c3 process. I would hate to exclude them because they are doing very good work. But I still think there needs to be a standard of some sort.
Well, that's a very good point, because there are some good ones out there that I'm not even aware of that are not 501.
Right, and some are, it takes them a while. Thank Dog Rescue is one that, from our part of the state, they are now 501c3, but it took them a while to get there, again, to raise the funds. We in New Haven sort of default to that, because that's all we have right now to judge that standard, but there might be other ways to, and in fact, one could even argue the 501c3 setup really isn't purposely designed for animal rescues. It just sort of happens to fit under that.
So then under this category, do we just focus in on the registration aspect then? Right.
I mean, I think it's a start. It's a building block. It's a foundation to the framework is what it would be.
So that registration would not mandate the 501 status, which is what we're seeing here. Because Paul is correct, there are some good, really good organizations that aren't 501c3s.
So is it implied then to have them have an organization register would mean there have to be qualifications for registration? We would, I guess, be responsible for determining what those qualifications would be.
So is it fair to say that, much like some of the other motions that we put forward today, that we do some research on what some other states are doing on this?
Right? Sure.
Yeah.
Is that something that the Office of Legislative Research can help us with? Okay.
quite honestly, nothing comes to mind.
Right.
I mean, we could be the first.
It could be the first to do this.
Well, I mean, you could see what Vermont requires.
Mm-hmm.
I know that they're registered with the Department of Agriculture.
Oh,
and what their guidelines are, or what the state of Maine requires, or
yeah.
the state of New Hampshire.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Deborah, any? Did you have a comment there?
No. I think that sounds like a good idea.
So let me try to formulate this motion. A motion, can we entertain a motion, or have a motion, to have the Office of Legislative Research do the research for us to find out what other states are doing in terms of having models in place that are registering these organizations and keeping out of that research whether or not they're 501(c)s, okay?
Mm-hmm.
All right, so that's the motion. Can someone make that motion? Or make the motion? So move. Okay. Is there a second?
Yeah, I'll second.
Okay, we have a motion. We have a second. Any other discussions? All right, hearing none. All those in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Very good. Motion passes. And thank you again to OLR for helping us with that. That's a very great asset for us, your research. And if there's something that you can't come up with that I can get CCM involved, we'll do that also. All right. Brian, did you have anything?
No.
Okay. So I think that covers the seven sections. Now let's move back to the agenda if we could. And in terms of time and date meetings, I have prepared a suggested format of upcoming meetings. And we can pass those down.
Sure.
And once everyone gets a copy, I'll explain this, okay? What I would like to propose for your consideration is, since we're meeting here on Wednesday, October 1st, from 2 to 4 here at the LOB, I've picked Wednesdays every month moving forward. And these are the Wednesdays. You'll see some in 2015, on July 8th instead of July 1st, which is the first Wednesday, I pushed it to the 8th because of the 4th of July. I'd like to say that this presumes that we're going to be able to continue this task force, because SB 309 is written such that it ends in January. But because we've gotten started later, I've already been talking to the Senate and the House in terms of potentially amending the bill to keep this task force going. And I know in talking to Ray, the Department of Agriculture, I think, would support that initiative, right, in talking our conversation yesterday. So for the sake of today's meeting, I wanted to bring forward a meeting schedule that takes us through the end of December 2015. Anybody have any comments on this? It would be the same time, 2 to 4 here at the LOB. Ray? Oh, sorry. Yes.
My comment is that during the legislative session, which will be January through June, Wednesdays are really busy days in terms of committee meetings and session days, so you might want to pick another day during the session. And I would look out to the lobbyists who are here to see if they agree. It's probably a better day.
So we have 3, 4, 5. So then from January 7th through June 3rd of 2015, those are the dates that would be in question then? All right. Okay. And is that flexibility in the form of a day or a time? Meaning, is it? So
what I'm saying is, you can set it now, but it would be good to consider that they might need to be changed.
Okay. So it's
don't consider them set in stone.
Right. And those dates from January through June are the only ones that you see would be in question then? Okay. So if we accepted this as the framework, sometime in November, December, as we're approaching that, we can then make the adjustments there then. And who could help us from your office, Planning and Development, to tell us what some other time options would be?
They have
Right.
You can go in and look at it and you
okay.
can observe things now.
Okay.
But if the committee needs it for a committee meeting or a public hearing, we would have to change so that they can have it.
Okay.
And then we have to find somewhere else that we're trying to get.
So I can work with Peter on that then?
Yes, yes.
Okay.
He can set up all the
Very good.
Now.
All right.
And then the only problem would be that if a committee needed it for a meeting or a hearing, it would have to be adjusted to find it. Eight
right.
Fridays,
okay. And how quickly would we know if so we would know that in January then?
Yeah.
That, okay. But Peter could give me an alternate option date
yes,
that we
yes.
can communicate. Very good. Okay. All right. So
I just want to ask, can this task force meet while the well when they're in session once they start to go in? There's no prohibition on that, right? Because there are no including this.
I do believe task
force
can.
Task force is 10?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Okay.
So
thanks.
Okay. So essentially what we have here is a framework of meetings. We know we're good at least through December 3rd if these dates work for everybody. And then in December or perhaps even November, I'll work with Peter and present to him these dates, and then I'll communicate back to the task force on this. Okay, well, Peter and I will. All right. Any comments on these dates, on the template anyway, for Wednesday 2 to 4?
No, I have a conflict with November 5th. I have a hoarding task force meeting on that date, which and I actually got to be in Stanford that morning. Or something else, and hopefully get to the. And it's at the exact same time. It's 2 to 4, and
yes.
That's in Newington.
All right. Well, I'd like to, in these commissions and task forces, we always like to be very flexible to have full attendance. So, what I'll do is this: we'll try to see if we can change that date. I'll work with Peter. Maybe it's the Thursday. Maybe it's Tuesday's election day, November 4th.
Right,
that
yeah.
would be a bad day.
Yeah, you don't want to do that.
But we'll pick a day, Ray, to make sure you're here.
I'd appreciate that.
And by the way, on an ongoing basis, if after we even establish these dates, if there's a commission member that says we can't make it, I'd like all of us to try to consider being flexible to accommodate all of the different task force members. Here,
absolutely.
Okay? So we will work towards a different date. And we'll be back in touch on that, okay? All right, so I'd like to have a motion to at least accept the template of dates, and the motion will include knowing that we have to be flexible on some of the dates and times. Can I have a motion?
So moved.
Okay. Wait a second.
Okay.
Any other discussion? All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. All right, we've kind of run right down to the wire here. 9 minutes left in this meeting, and before we have a motion to adjourn, I'd like to say that I'd like to thank everyone for their time here, their feedback. I hope everyone feels this was a productive discussion for a first meeting, and I'm struck with how cohesive and how much chemistry there was on this task force in the first meeting. So I'd like to thank everyone for that. That's not something we normally see with other boards and commissions, so I'm very grateful. With that being said, before we adjourn, any other comments or discussion? Mark?
For the exact same reasons, I'd like to thank our co-chairs for running such a wonderful meeting today and getting us started in this direction. Thank you both.
Welcome. Diane, any closing comments? Or?
Okay.
All right. So can we have a motion for adjournment? We have a second. I almost don't want to adjourn. We had such a nice
right.
meeting here. So, okay, all those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Thank you very much for your time. Thank you.
You.